For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, your two favorite troglodytes, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle. And here on the Catholic Cave, we talk about a lot of philosophical concepts. And the one that comes up on a very frequent basis is the term metaphysics. Now, I looked it up, and the definition I found is metaphysics is the branch of philosophy that deals with the first principles of things, including abstract concepts such as being, knowing, substance, cause, identity, time, and space. Okay, I just got buzzed because whatever that was, it just went right over my head. Please explain.
Yeah, I was going to say, even my eyes glazed over a little bit with that definition. And I think that's the problem in some ways with metaphysics is when people hear metaphysics, they hear the word and they get scared. Metaphysics is that branch of philosophy that is by definition completely 100% abstract. And according to some philosophers, therefore completely and absolutely unknowable. So when people hear things like substance, being, time, causality, yeah, your eyes glaze over or it just goes over your head. So, Tim, we're going to have to discuss metaphysics, but we're going to have to discuss it in a way that is exciting. It's fun. We're going to bring...
That's a tall order, buddy. Yeah, unless you're really geeky like we are. We'll make it interesting.
We're going to bring the fun back to metaphysics.
Right.
Okay, and in order to do that, I'm going to start you off with a concept here.
Okay.
And Descartes said, to know is to be. Sartre said, to be is to know. Now, my favorite philosopher, Frank Sinatra, said, do be do be do. What does it mean to be? What is being?
Well, obviously, there's a whole cottage industry of books that are written on that question. So giant things. So let's start at the beginning to get at this. Philosophy starts pretty much with two characters, Plato and his student Aristotle. And Plato posited that the root of all things, so everything that exists, is rooted in forms. They're rooted in ideas. They're rooted in these sort of cookie cutters that all of reality comes
exemplars,
from. Exemplars, exactly. Mm-hmm. And you can't see them. They're abstract. But you know they're there because of sort of the similarities and comparisons of things that are like each other. So if you see horses, for instance, you can recognize that there must be a form of a horse that all of these somehow participate in. All of these horses had to have come from some central sort of form or idea that they all share together, but you can't see it. You can't sense it. It's beyond the senses. And that's really where metaphysics comes from, is what is it that's beyond the senses, but is necessary for us to have these sort of categories of things, these sort of similarities, and not only that, but the actions and interactions between things that we see. So when one thing causes another, what is it that's actually happening there? Because these are things that we can't see. So Plato started that whole conversation by saying, well, there must be this invisible realm of forms and ideas. And his student Aristotle said, they're not quite so invisible. You can see those forms actually in the things, and positing the idea that they're somehow separable from the things themselves, that's a step too far. You know, Occam came much, much later, but he had the whole theory of Occam's razor, where you look for the simplest explanation. And Aristotle said the simplest explanation is everything has a form, but it's not something that you could pull out of it and separate it from its matter. It's all just there. But that's also kind of leading to that metaphysical idea. So those two ideas, that there are preconditions for things and substances and just the entire universe that have to be there that we can't sense. They're abstract. They're beyond our senses. But they have to be there to be able to account for the interaction of things and the nature of things. That's sort of Aristotle's idea. Plato's idea is what you think is simply the preconditions for things are actually real. They actually exist in this whole other realm of forms. And really, honestly, the whole idea of metaphysics kind of are footnotes on those two ideas.
Yeah, I might begin with a tie into the name of the show, which is the Catholic cave. So the cave part is we're borrowing from Plato's allegory of the cave. And it's in that allegory of the cave, I think, Mark, what you're talking about is it's when you come out of the cave and you move into that realm of the divine ideas or the divine forms. That's where universal concepts exist. And so everything partic- so according to Plato and his allegory of the cave, that is where you have exemplars, these ideas, these abstract ideas from which in the physical world, material world, you have instances or a kind of participation in it. So like you mentioned, like with the horse, as children are being educated, one of the first things parents do along the way is you begin to teach them like what different animals are. But we know whether it's horses or I might use dogs. I've used this in the past in other shows. When you think about what a dog is, there's all kinds of aspects or characteristics to dogs where there's a lot of variety. They have different sizes, different colors, different coats, and so one might when you're teaching, say, a toddler, trying to teach them the category of dog. What you're helping them do when you point at a picture of, say, a toy poodle and a fully grown German Shepherd, and you're saying these two things are both dogs, despite the difference in size, color, coat, what you're helping the child to do is engage in abstract thinking. In other words, by abstract thinking, what we're trying to do is we're trying to pull out the essence of what it means to be category of dog and leave behind what Aristotle would call the accidental or mere characteristics that are not essential to being a dog. Like the color of a coat doesn't define what a dog is. We would say, so what would the form include? The form of a dog would include things like a tail and four legs and a snout and ears and things like that. The fact that they would have a fur coat, that they're covered in hair, they would have a fur coat, that's part of it too. But that's what we're trying to get at. So Plato and others, when we think about metaphysics, one of the things we're trying to get at is that there are things like forms, substantial forms, divine forms, divine ideas that can only be known by the mind.
Right. And that was pretty much the explanation of metaphysics for most of Western history. When, throughout the Middle Ages, when you studied metaphysics, that's pretty much what you studied. But gradually those ideas began to become questioned. And I say gradually because there's two figures that I think really started to question that idea of this sort of existence of a realm outside of reality or a realm within reality that you could not sense, that was completely 100% abstract. As you say, you know, to get to the idea of a universal, you have to abstract something. It's not something you can sense. And the first of those characters is William of Ockham.
And William, yes.
And so William of Ockham,
quite a troublemaker, I would say, a Franciscan. but yes.
But you know, he made the observation that a lot of reality doesn't seem to necessarily completely fit within these boxes. And his idea was, well, that's because these boxes don't really exist. The idea of a universal is simply a convenient way for us to organize thoughts. So we experience a whole bunch of different animals, And it's sort of arbitrary which of these boxes those animals go in. Well, we can put all of them that are four-legged in this box over here, and so we can call those four-legged animals, and we can attach a label to them. Okay, so this box has the label of four-legged animals, and then over here we've got two-legged animals, and we can attach a name to that. But honestly, those names and those labels and those boxes that we're putting those animals in have nothing to do with the animals themselves. The animals are just there. They exist, and it's people and our own attempt to understand them that puts them in their boxes.
Yeah. We either are putting them in their boxes, or we're recognizing that boxes exist of which they're participating. So when we move from, say, substantial forms that pertain to, say, living creatures, there are, so thinking about, like, again, the word dog, or that dogs have a certain kind of nature, and we know, we look at certain animals and we can abstract out what the essence is. And if they have the animal has the essence or the essential qualities of what it means to be a dog, then that's what we name them. That's a naming convention that we use the term dog. So that we would say this, like my dog, Barney, I have a dog named Barney. He's a 120-pound, maybe 130-pound, depending on how many treats he's had, is a chocolate lab. So I think Plato and others would say he's an instance, a particular example of a dog. He's a dog, and he has the nature of a dog, the essential qualities of a dog, even though his accidental qualities or characteristics are at variance to other dogs. So he has a very short brown coat. That's different from, say, again, a German Shepherd's coat. Yet we would look at the breed German Shepherd and Chocolate Lab and both identify them. So there's something about this, Nate, that living things or living things especially, it's easy to see that they participate. They have a certain kind of nature. This is the grounding for something like referring to people, each person, as belonging to something more broadly, like a human family, a family of persons or human beings, because we all have a human nature.
Right. And you know, that kind of illustrates, I think, the stakes of this discussion around metaphysics. Yeah, we started saying people are scared of metaphysics because it's abstract, it's hard to understand. But I also think there's an element of being scared of metaphysics because the stakes are so high.
Yeah, and one of those metaphysical concepts that we may touch on sometime during our show today is time. And what it is right now is time for us to take a break on the Catholic Cave. We'll be back with more on Catholic Radio Indy right after this.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford, and we are talking metaphysics. So,
woohoo! Exciting!
So we talked in the first segment broadly about what I would call classical metaphysics. Mm-hmm. The idea that there are certain ideas and concepts that are abstract that you have to understand to be able to account for the existence of everything else. And I brought up William of Ockham of being kind of the first one that cast some doubt on the actual existence of this category of
divine forms.
Yeah, divine forms, yeah. Or universals.
Would you say he's a nominalist? Nominalism?
Yeah, well, he's the father of nominalism.
Yeah. And I did have a professor at Franciscan University who, he took issue with that. He didn't like that. But anyway, that's a different journey.
Well, yeah, because nominalism, I think gets to the idea of, well, everything has an arbitrary label. But I think that's really a miscasting of nominalism. Nominalism is things are sorted by human beings according to comparison and what we see as similarities. Mm-hmm. So the actual similarities aren't things that reside in themselves. They're similarities that we see just from experience. So, mm-hmm. you know, we see Barney, your
Barney the Wonder Dog, 120-pound chocolate lab.
The 120-pound chocolate lab, and we see that he acts very similarly to the German Shepherd that's across the fence. Mm-hmm. And we see that, you know, while they can actually, if Barney hops the fence, they could potentially mate and create other dogs. So we see some similarities that they're related that way. But really, when you get down to it, the German Shepherd is a German Shepherd with the name of Fifi, and Barney is...
That might be the poodle's name. German Shepherd might be more like Kurt.
and Barney...
Or Wilhelm.
You know, Barney's Barney. Right. And the reality of them are two separate entities that mm-hmm. we see similarities, we see interactions, we see how they're related, mm-hmm. but all of that are based on our observations as human beings. They don't have anything to do with the dogs themselves. Mm-hmm. So that I think is probably what I would consider the better explanation of nominalism. So William Ockham is one early critic of the whole idea of universals. The other critic is the subtle doctor. And his criticism, obviously, would be a little more subtle. And that's Duns Scotus. And so Duns mm-hmm. Scotus was a student of St. Thomas, but he was also a little bit of a critic of St. Thomas Aquinas. And that mm-hmm. should, you know, that should be a warning right there. Don't go, you know, tread very lightly when you want to become a critic of St. Thomas Aquinas. But I think Duns Scotus actually perhaps had some actual real issues and thoughts that have to be considered seriously. And what Scotus basically said is, if you take Aristotle's understanding of the universe, that there are universal forms that dictate what the matter is, and that there are four causes of things, and that those causes of things sort of encapsulate all of reality and can account for all of reality. You know, Aristotle said, if you want to understand something, you've got to understand the four causes of them. And those are metaphysical concepts in and of themselves. That if you take that and you make the whole universe adhere to this Aristotelian framework, which is kind of what St. Thomas Aquinas was trying to do, you leave no room for God. God has been constrained by the metaphysics, and God ultimately becomes a metaphysical form himself. And so Scotus said there's something really wrong about that, that God has to be able to transcend metaphysics. God has to be outside metaphysics, which means God has to be the one that's sort of in control of the metaphysical landscape. So where St. Thomas Aquinas would say, to a certain extent, God can't do anything that's irrational. God is reason himself, and mm-hmm. the universe follows these rational rules because mm-hmm. of God. Scotus said, but that's constraining God. That's constraining God to rationality. And so God really has to be able to do what God wants. And so mm-hmm. that's not to say that there's going to be mass amounts of irrationality in the world, but that is to say that the rationality of the world comes at a level that's sort of below the divine will, that's below the mm-hmm. will of God, and that it's the will of God that's really controlling all of the metaphysical side of nature. And that has some huge ramifications, and I think that really sets the stage for the skepticism that comes later in the modern age.
Yeah, and I think chronologically it's... well, he's a blessed too, I believe. Blessed John Duns Scotus. And then, William of Ockham follows in his footsteps and takes it even further. Well, one thing I've noticed, though, is that, I think Scotus, to a certain extent, he probably overreaches. You don't find, for example, in our... So this is, you know, 800 years ago. You still find, eminent schools... especially Catholic universities in particular, of Thomism, right? Of people studying the works of St. Thomas Aquinas. There's been encyclicals holding them up, say by Pope Leo XIII as an example, as the exemplar, St. John Paul the Great, all extolling the inestimable value of studying Aquinas. You don't find anything like that about Scotus or Ockham. So they've been kind of left behind, because I think part of what their philosophy has done is it's been found lacking. So it's interesting. I find SCOTUS to read his writings in English. Not that I've read him in other languages anyway. He wrote in Latin. But he's nearly impenetrable. I mean, I find him very, very difficult. So I've had to get at his work through other scholars. But they've left him behind. I think academia has left him behind for good reason.
You know, I wouldn't be quite so quick to cast off either of the two of them, and particularly Occam. I think Occam has had a long lasting impact on philosophy. But both.
I agree with the impact. I'm just saying no one stands in his footsteps and say, well, I'm a. Right. Occamanian or whatever you call yourself,
but
he's had impact. I would agree with that.
But they weren't systematizers, and I think that's the you have some philosophers like St. Thomas Aquinas, like Aristotle. I would argue like Kant down the road that create systems, and then you have other philosophers that come behind them and are depending on how you look at it. They're either critics of the system, or they are ones who improve upon the system. So they build upon the system. Spinoza would be a great example of this. You have Descartes that creates the whole Cartesian framework and the whole Cartesian system that has a lot of holes in it. It has a lot of problems in it. Spinoza comes along and improves it. He makes it better. He makes it make a lot more sense. And he's able to do that as a critic. Duns Scotus and, to a lesser extent, William of Ockham play that role with St. Thomas Aquinas. They are critiquing and looking at holes and problems that exist within the Thomistic system and improving it.
So there are no holes in the Thomistic system.
so you don't
have... They allege there are. I would say there aren't.
Right. So you're not going to have somebody that's becoming a Scotian, you know, for instance.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Right, because they're not systematizers. That's not what they were about. Right. They were not creating these great big edifices. They were critiquing or trying to improve upon...
Yeah, but no one's picked up their work. That's fair. I'm probably overstating it. But no one's picked up their work and tried to advance like Scotus. We simply acknowledge
there's them. Actually, I think there's actually a revival of re-looking and reconsidering some of Scotus's thoughts going on at the moment. One of which comes across more in the theological realm. And so the philosophy of it, especially since we're talking about metaphysics, it gets filtered into theology. And that's the idea that God does not know universals. That's part of the Scotus's critique is... Because of God's divine will, because of God's divine love, he's not confined to loving things and knowing things as kind. His intellect and his will is able to know the universe in its particularity. So, he doesn't know you as a man. He doesn't know you as an American. He doesn't know you as any of the sort of universal concepts that you would consider universals. God simply knows Tim as Tim, and he knows Tim as Tim all the way down. It's only human beings that have to understand things in concepts of universals. God's intellect himself isn't confined to universals. God knows everything in its particularity. That's making a comeback, I think, when you listen to some of the theology that's coming out based on personalism. So, you know, personalism comes out of John Paul II, but the idea behind personalism is that God is intimately connected with every aspect of reality, and therefore God is intimately connected with you, and he knows you as a particular, as an individual, long before he would know you as a man, an American, or even a Catholic.
I would have to look into that. I'm not so sure I would agree with that premise. It sounds problematic on its surface. I would say it'd be interesting, though, to... I would say this nominalism that comes out of Occam, I think, does prove to be highly problematic. Or even as you're describing, I mean, kind of what I'm hearing is you're describing like Scotus and his emphasis on the divine will. It begins to remind me a little bit about a problem that exists in Islam, and where Islam has a hyper accentuation on God's will at the abandonment of reason. that God can will, the killing of the innocents and also prohibit it at the same time. So like violations of laws of non-contradiction. That's why I think probably SCOTUS, maybe he's getting another look. I don't know. But I think that's one of the reasons why his a school of SCOTUS never really emerged or hasn't emerged to advance his thinking. And there's lots of examples where that happens. So take a more contemporary example. I'll take someone who I've read, I would say a fair amount of, Bernard Lonergan, who was quite prominent for a while in the 20th century, you know, around the time of Vatican II and post Vatican II immediately. I would say he's attempting something pretty interesting, which is kind of like he's trying to bring together kind of Kant and Aquinas. But ultimately I think his project fails. There's very few people left. There's a few Jesuits, I would say, because he was a Jesuit. He was one of the Wiley Jesuits, I would say. There's a few that maybe still stand in his camp, but they're on the verge of extinction. So there are lots of thinkers that come and go, tickle our fancy for a while, but don't prove to have the longevity that like an Aquinas and maybe some others have, because while they touch on a few interesting, unique points, ultimately their project fails. And it just kind of drops out, you know, kind of drops out of academia.
Right. And I think that's partly the nature of metaphysics. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about metaphysical systems and the critiques of those systems and the interplay between the two.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
Welcome back once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford, and we are continuing our discussion of metaphysics. And we were just talking the last segment, we were talking about Duns Scotus and Aristotle and I guess more particularly St. Thomas Aquinas and the interplay between the two. And I, you know, Tim's ready to dismiss St. Thomas or Duns Scotus. He's really,
yeah, not Aquinas, not buddy. Aquinas, yeah. That's my guy.
Right. Tim's ready to dismiss Scotus.
Right.
And my position is that, no, you've got certain figures within the history of philosophy that are more critics. And then you've got other figures that are much more systematizers. They're the ones that build the systems. And what makes a system is a metaphysical understanding and the concepts of metaphysics, and a system that allows those metaphysical, I guess, abstractions to be able to hold that whole system together. But of course, it needs some tinkering. It needs some help. And it also needs some critiquing sometimes. And so you have other figures that then come and critique the systems of others. So when you're studying great philosophical systems, you're only going to study those systematizers. You're only going to study the Aristotles or the Platos or the St. Thomas Aquinas's or the Kant's. You're not going to study the critics of them. And so I think to understand a system and to understand metaphysics, you got to look at both. You've got to look at the big system, but then you've also got to look at the critiques. You've got to look at the people that are there playing devil's advocate and just sort of trying to poke holes at it. But their whole idea is not to necessarily build
their own system. You didn't see, but Mark was literally here in the studio trying to poke me when he said that.
So as I said, you know, the critique of St. Thomas Aquinas' system, and I think we're going to take him as the metaphysician par excellence.
Yes, right? So, absolutely.
So St. Thomas Aquinas, at least the initial metaphysician, par excellence, because I think there's some philosophical merit to you. You mentioned Bernard Lonergan's theological project of trying to wed Kant with St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah, philosophical too. I think Insight was his big book.
Yeah, I think
when it got published, he was.
Well, he was definitely much more of a theologian as far as training and temperament and disposition.
But he was surprised, and Lonergan himself was surprised that his book actually got published because it was so radical.
Right.
But, you know, there was a lot going on in the, I don't know when it was published, late 60s. I mean, late 50s, early 60s, something like that.
Right. But anyway, we already talked a little bit about some of the critiques. We talked about Duns Scotus's critique that, you know, when you have a metaphysical system, it will tend to constrain God. And now you're trying to say God is contained by certain necessities, that there are certain ways that God has to act and he can't act in other ways, that God's will is therefore constrained. That really
which I would hold to.
Right. But that really bugged Scotus. And yeah. I can see why, because when you're talking about an omnipotent being, what you're talking about is his power, right? So the power of God himself has to be able to a good extent, transcend being itself. And that's kind of what Scotus was sort of pointing at. We talked about William of Ockham, that was questioning the whole idea of universals as something that actually existed within reality itself. And he brought up the idea that, no, these universal principles are things that we just use to categorize what we see. And when you finally get to modernism, and of course Descartes is the great father of modernism, what you have is this attempt to get back to the roots of things and therefore discard all of the past systems and rebuild your own system from the get-go, which I think is in some ways maybe a noble project, but I think the instinct there is probably foolish from the get-go to just throw off 2,000 years of tradition and what's been built up and not, you know, basically
as if no one's found any truth up to this moment in your life.
Right. And Descartes, I think, would quibble with that and say, no, it's not that nobody came up with any truth. What he was worried about was the certainty of it. You know, there were these.
So he adopts radical skepticism.
Right. There were these quibbles going on between St. Thomas Aquinas and Scotus and Ockham and these other people, and they were quibbling, and there seemed to be no certainty to even what these terms meant, right? You're talking about completely abstract concepts. So when you have an abstract concept, how can you have any certainty? So he was bothered by this, and he was a mathematician. You know, mathematics deals with certainties in a very abstract sense. So he said, if there can be abstract certainties within mathematics, why can't there be abstract certainties within the realm of metaphysics? So he wanted to find a absolute, undoubtable foundation to be able to rebuild metaphysics. And as I said, his judgment of just casting off all past tradition seems, I don't know. Who am I to judge, I guess? But it does seem a little foolhardy. But nonetheless, he decided he would try to find that undoubtable principle, and he found it within his own existence. So what he did is he started to rebuild metaphysics based on the idea of existence, which bootstraps the concept of existence, because what does St. Thomas Aquinas say the relationship between existence and being is, Tim?
I don't know.
Essence, maybe beings, bringing in a more modern term. What's the relationship between existence and essence?
Well, I would say for a thing to anything that exists has to have an act of existence called actus essendi, and then the principle of essence is a limiting principle that makes a thing what it is and not something else.
Right. But
so in a created being, your essence and your existence are not the same, where they are the same for God.
Right. And they are the same for God, but essence precedes logically existence is what St. Thomas Aquinas say. I think he would say it possibly that way.
I'd say the opposite.
Well, okay, but to say the opposite is to say the opposite is to say that therefore in reality, i.e. from God's perspective, essence precedes existence. But from God's perspective, they're one.
For God's existence, for being itself.
Oh, for God himself, for being himself, right? Yeah. But he's
being
the
with
only,
capital B.
Right, but he's the only being.
Correct.
Right.
Whose existence and essence right. are.
But St. Thomas Aquinas would say essence precedes existence. And that's his fundamental. I mean, that's his.
Maybe.
He wrote a whole book that's the thesis. So I'm not sure you can say maybe.
Yeah. Well, no, I've read that. I just don't remember it that way. I kind of remember. I'd have to go look. So I'll defer to you. I don't remember. I seem to remember it being the other way around, but go ahead.
How could existence precede essence?
Well, essence has to reside in, you can't have essence without existence. So I would say existence, something has to exist. And then within its existence, the actus ascendi, within its essence, the essence is the limiting principle, or we would call it the substantial form that makes a thing what it is and not something else. So I don't see how you would have so within the form itself has an act of existence.
But you have non-existent being. I mean,
what would be a non-existent being?
Non-existent being is potentiality.
I don't know if I would. I don't know if I would. I don't know if I would categorize. I'd have to give that some more thought. I don't know if I would put it that way.
Okay, but anyway, you have potentiality. The potentiality comes.
Yeah,
into,
potentiality and
comes
actuality.
Into existence. Exactly. So mm-hmm. So potentiality comes into existence when it's actualized, and so you have essential being that becomes actualized that then gives it existence.
Yeah, but I would say potentiality is real.
Correct.
It's a feature. Right.
Right.
So it's not a non-being.
Right. And that's essential. Right. That's the essence of something. It's potential. It's its formal reality.
It's a feature of it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's formal reality.
Well, maybe we're saying the same thing.
And then existence comes after that. So you have potentiality, which for God has no potentiality, so his essence is his existence. It's one and the same. But for created reality, existence, basically you have essential reality that then is brought into existence.
Well, I'll have to give that some more thought. I don't know. Yeah, I'd have to get more thought. I don't know. Are you saying that potentiality is in a category outside of existence, and then it moves.
Correct. By definition, it's non-existent being.
Well, all right. Let's keep going then.
Nonetheless.
I got to think about that.
Okay,
I'm not sure.
No, because I think this is a fantastic demonstration mm-hmm. of Descartes' point. That Descartes said you had these quibbles over things that, you know.
Yeah, like how many angels can dance in the head of a pin.
Right.
That's sort of a classic
Well,
one.
You know, I think that's a
and
little bit
of
red
herring. And then they mock SCOTUS.
Right, yeah.
And that's where you get dunce cap from. Right.
But that's a little bit of a red herring. I think mm-hmm. I think Descartes' point was there's no certainty within these metaphysical principles. And I think the reason why is because they are completely abstract. So he wanted to find a grounding within reality, an indubitable grounding that you could experience that would bring about. And I think that's the key there, that you could experience. So from Descartes on, basically the validity of truth becomes experiential based, whether it's something that you can experience in the physical world or whether it's something you can experience in the subjective world. The reality and existence of things comes based on experience, which throws into doubt pretty much all of metaphysics. And it was David Hume that I think was the one that was probably the biggest exponent for this. That I mean, to be the short, crude version of Hume, if you can't see it, touch it, taste it, pass it through your lower intestine, it's not real. That's pretty much Hume's.
I've not heard it put that way.
And so Hume casts into doubt. It casts into doubt the whole idea of even a metaphysical system. Mm. For Hume, all you can do is sort of experience reality in its rawest form. And the metaphysical concept he spends time looking at is causality, because it's the one that I think we experience the most. It's the one closest to physical experience. We take it for
cause
granted.
And effect.
But the idea that cause and effect are connected to each other is a metaphysical concept. And Hume says, well, you can't experience it. It's not that cause and effect is not something that you can experience, even though we think we can. Mm. And so he calls that into doubt, and he demonstrates that the idea that a cause is going to create an effect is not something that we can know through experience or experimentation or whatever else.
It's not a reliable connection.
Right. It's just something that we assume.
When we come back from, I think we got to take a break, right, Kent? I want to pick up, I've got a little Hume trivia because he's been in the news recently. And maybe when we come back, I'll talk about that.
And we'll be back with more of The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
At Catholic Radio, we love to hear from you. Call us anytime. Just recently, we found this message on our voicemail.
I'm a non-Catholic that listens to your Catholic radio station, and I just wanted to thank you guys. I listen to Catholic Answers and Al Cresta sometimes, and I think her name's Teresa Tommy. I listen to her and another show or two. I appreciate it.
Call us at 317-870-8400 and let us know what you're thinking.
I just called to say, you know, I'm not a Catholic. I listen to your station.
Ever since we've been on the air at Catholic Radio, we've always wanted to have billboards, but they just don't fit in our budget. And since you'll probably never see a real billboard for us, I'm going to ask you to do something, to imagine one. In your mind, picture a large, empty billboard. Yeah, that's it. Now pick a background color, any color at all. Okay, then across the top of your billboard, put just two words, Catholic Radio. Make them really big. Then, below that in even bigger letters, put 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Wow, that's a great billboard. Now, if this billboard were real, all of your friends and neighbors could see it, and they'd know all about Catholic Radio. But since it's only an imaginary billboard, we're going to have to depend on you to tell your friends about Catholic Radio. Remember, Catholic Radio 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Oh, and by the way, nice choice on that background color. It really looks good.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell with Mark Tuttle, Kent Blanford. We've been talking metaphysics, and right before end of the last segment, we were talking about David Hume. David Hume is a very renowned, certainly well-known within philosophy departments, those who study philosophy, maybe beyond that. He was Scottish. He lived in the 18th century and happened to know he was born in like 1711 and died about a month after the Declaration of Independence here in America. So a couple of things that are kind of noteworthy about him is that he was, you know, well known for his philosophical writings at the time, but was denied a professorship at the university because he had a reputation for being an atheist. And that was, of course, scandalous. And so he was denied that professorship. So while he was able to teach and lecture, he just never achieved that status. And then he, to make amends for it, I want to say about a century ago, maybe less, the university, I want to say University of Edinburgh, but I could be mistaken there, University of St. Andrews maybe. But that university, to sort of make amends for that, looking back, that was kind of a slight, they went ahead and named one of their buildings on campus after David Hume's as a way to kind of make amends, to say, hey, you know, we probably shouldn't have, you know, we regret that that happened. And so when they built, well, now in our cancel culture, they're taking his name back off the building. And I read this, I don't know, it was Catholic World Report, something like that, the Catholic thing, very recently. And they're taking his name back off because, you know, he wrote a ton of stuff. But at least according to this article, there were a handful or a dozen sentences that seemed that were suggestive of a kind of had racist language in it, and therefore the university is now removing his name. So he's getting canceled.
Right. But, you know, the initial episode in that story, I think, is very illustrative of the stakes of metaphysics. People's eyes gloss over. They're afraid. Metaphysics seems intimidating. But the very idea of whether you believe in God or whether you don't believe in God, in a lot of ways, is contingent on your understanding of metaphysics.
Absolutely.
You know, and if you're
it's the single biggest question.
If you're a complete skeptic the way David Hume was, you're going to arrive at the idea that there is no God very quickly. And so, you know,
which in itself flows all kinds of implications, right. Yep. That are often riddled with errors.
Right, right. The instinct that the University of Edinburgh had about David Hume being an atheist is, I think, a completely 100% correct assessment of David Hume's philosophy.
I worry that, though, a lot of philosophy departments are full of atheists these days, maybe the majority.
Right. But, you know, David Hume...
Even at Catholic universities.
You know, David Hume was skeptical of the existence of anything outside of empirical reality to the extent that it led him to doubt... Mm-hmm. Metaphysical concepts that led him to doubt the existence of metaphysics outside of the material realm. And I think we're kind of there to a good extent with our reliance on science to be the recipe for telling us truth, right? So truth is only something that you can discover through experimentation. You know, Descartes divided the world into a material world where science was the definitive answer, but he also left the res cogitans, the things of thought, the
spiritual realities.
Right. Yeah. And you know, Descartes was a very devout Catholic. I don't think there's any, you know, mm-hmm. to me, I know some people try to argue that he must have been an atheist because he went against St. Thomas Aquinas.
I don't think I don't think
there's any.
You might evidence. Be a heretic to go against Aquinas, but I don't think that necessarily makes you an atheist.
But Hume pretty much denied that whole second realm that Descartes had posited, and it left no room for God, and it left no room for metaphysics. And based on this observation, that's where kind of Immanuel Kant, as he put it himself, you know, Hume sort of shook him out of his dogmatic slumber.
nice.
And he woke up from his dogmatic slumber and realized, you know, David Hume and other empiricists had done such damage to the metaphysical world that the metaphysical landscape needed to be rebuilt. And it needed to be rebuilt on a more fundamental grounding that allowed for this interplay between the things of thought and the things of reality. And so Kant went to try to sort of recreate a new system that was based on empiricism, that was based on this idea that, you know, the way we can explore truth and know definitively whether something's true or not is through empirical science. But we still need to leave room for the realm of metaphysics and ultimately the realm of God. So, you know, there's a lot of writing in Kant's, in the whole study of Kant's thought that I think is good evidence that Kant's ultimate project was to try to save God from David Hume.
Well, I think, too, it's worth mentioning, especially when we think about the 18th century and the thinkers and what's going on, just a historical context around there are so many scientific discoveries happening. There's, you know, you're still sort of in the wake of the discovery of the new world. You have, you know, Sir Isaac Newton, you know, revolutionizing physics and our understanding of the physical world. A great, great age of discovery. You know, there's missionary activity. There's exploration. And so that kind of environment sort of puts everything up for grabs, including, you know, perennial truths of philosophy, and so things are so it's ripe, that the atmosphere is ripe with skepticism, because it seems as if many of the things that we sort of held to be, that we thought we knew, are being challenged with new discoveries. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to create, and you have the Enlightenment Project. This sets the stage for the great errors of modernity.
Right. And I think, the growth in empirical science has a direct impact.
And its power.
It has a direct impact on philosophy and these philosophical systems. Sure. Descartes came about because he was a mathematician. He was actually an engineer. So he was working on trying to create mathematical models for, physical projects that he was putting mm-hmm. together. He advanced mathematics significantly doing this. But then you can see that impact in his sort of philosophical projects, that just like he's trying to find mathematical models for the physical the physical realm that he's dealing with. Now he says, well, why can't we find mathematical models for the cognitive realm?
Right.
And so he wants that same sort of certainty that you get from mathematics for the physical world. He wants an analog for that for the spiritual world.
That's very much an active project right now. One discovery I've made that I'm exploring is a PBS series called Closer to Truth. And it's really fascinating. It's got many, many seasons, 10 plus seasons. So I'm late to that party. But it's a show on philosophy. And so there's this the host is Dr. Kuhn, and he interviews experts, academics in these different fields of how they're trying to explain different aspects of, say, cosmology and metaphysics and things like that. And including I saw one recently where the topic was, is Jesus God, from a philosophical standpoint? And he interviews some pretty prominent theologians, including philosophers, including Eleanor Stump, who's a very renowned
right.
and well thought of Catholic philosopher. But also he interviews for this episode N.T. Wright, who's a very well respected, maybe the most respected kind of New Testament theologian. He's not Catholic, I think he's Anglican. But I mean, it's that caliber show. So that's, but they're still trying to, another episode I began is trying to figure out how Darwinian evolutionary theory explains consciousness. Because that's still one that's, if you're a strict materialist, consciousness is a tough one to grasp.
Right.
Or explain.
Right. And that goes back to Henri Bergson and his sort of
troublemaker too, I think.
But once again, he was a biologist first. So, it's the study of biology and the study of evolution that leads to his philosophical thought. Kind of like Descartes' study of mathematics. You have a mechanical sort of understanding that comes out of Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes was interested in mechanical science, and because of that, you have the whole empiricist movement that Hume was a part of. But that mechanical thing then impacts upon metaphysics, and that's where Kant kind of steps in. And so I'm going to throw this out there. We're going to get hate mail from the trained professional philosophers on this, because I'm going to...
Remember, that's Kent at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And I'll be more than happy to pass those right along to Tim and Mark.
But I'm going to posit that, after Hume put his critique on sort of traditional classical metaphysics, Kant took on the project of trying to rebuild metaphysics, and he tried to rebuild it. And this is where we're going to get the hate mail from the professional philosophers, because everybody's going to disagree with me. And I understand this is a one of those sort of...
You're speculating.
Weird, out there, speculative propositions. Mm-hmm. Kant tried to rebuild a metaphysical system based off of the observations of Duns Scotus and Occam. Not directly, because I don't know that he ever went and studied necessarily Scotus and Occam, but at least the ideas that were posited there in nominalism and voluntarism of Scotus and Occam, those are the essential foundations for how Kant tried to rebuild his metaphysical system.
That is an interesting speculation. I'd have to give that some more thought, because I hadn't heard that before. But Mark, we're about out of time, and there was still a lot of territory.
Well, we didn't even talk about time.
Right, exactly.
Time's a whole other metaphysical concept. Right. We didn't have time to talk about time.
That's right, and we didn't really get to some of the others. So we may have to take up metaphysics again. you know, metaphysics, the sort of stuff that happens before the studying the physical natural world. But I thought that we were able to advance the conversation in a productive way.
Yep. And that for today is Metaphysics 101. We'll look forward to at some point in the near future doing Metaphysics 102, where we'll pick up where we left off. For Timothy O'Donnell, for Mark Tuttle, I'm Kent Blanford. You've been listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.